Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gematis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society. Well, it's not Dave today, it's Graham here, Graham Laycock, along with John Axtell for Stars Over Surrey. And a bit of a sad occasion, really, because after 5 years, it's your final edition, John.
It is indeed, but I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope the listeners have too.
Indeed. Well, let's get down to business then. What's been happening in space?
Okay, well, let's start off with Mars. The Perseverance rover, of course, is the main one that people will remember recently landing, and that's been sending back some interesting pictures of late, but also Curiosity has the rover that's almost the twin of Perseverance, which landed some time ago now in a different part of Mars. That too is still working away and has been returning some good pictures, and I've got several of those pictures in the slides that accompany this talk that can be found on the Brooklands Radio website, Stars Over Surrey page. So let's start with Perseverance. The rover's now at the Jezero Delta. It's been making its way back there over some very rough terrain, carefully mapping out its route with the pictures that it's taken, and also guided in part by the little helicopter that's been doing such a grand job. But now that it's reached the Delta, it's sent back a trove of images which clearly show the stratification of layers of rock. And one of the pictures that I show has something like, it looks like there must be a dozen or 20 layers of sedimentation. And that can only have been laid down over millions and millions of years, by water evaporating, leaving layers, such as we see when we go to the seaside and you look at the cliffs and you see this stratification. Things like sandstone and so on. And you can just imagine how earthbound geologists would love to be up there peeling away these layers one at a time, looking for fossils. Not dinosaurs like they do here, but are there any signs that in these sedimentary layers that perhaps some form of primitive life existed at some point? And in one of the pictures, there's an absolutely incredible sight of a tiny little, well, tiny is probably a metre or two across, but a boulder that's just sitting there, perched on top of another rock. It looks as though it's just balanced. Is probably caused by the Martian wind, although it's weak by Earth standards, not like you saw in that film, The Martian, which was rather exaggerated. But that wind over millions of years carrying small grains of sand will erode rock away. So some larger sedimentary rock has been whittled down and just leaving this final boulder perched there. But I must say, and other people have thought this too, some of the pictures sent back by Perseverance show, it reminds you of Monument Valley in Utah, or the part of an old Star Trek episode where Captain Kirk had to battle this alligator-looking creature called the Gorn. you could just expect the Gorn to come round the corner in the picture.
It hasn't so far.
Not at least Perseverance hasn't seen it.
Right.
It's keeping the other side of the camera.
Yeah, of course. There was a recent Brian Cox program on BBC about Mars.
Wasn't that good?
He was there for a week with all the pictures coming back. Yeah. One thing I brought up from that was the fact that, of course, if they do find something, is it actually a meteor from Earth that's landed on Mars?
And brought life?
Or did it happen the other way around? Did Mars have a meteorite on Earth? Both places have got these meteorites.
Well, of course, one of the original science fiction stories about Earth, our life coming from Mars, was a Quatermass series, Quatermass and the Pit. where the Martians had landed and brought some kind of pre-human as their food or something like that. All good stuff, all good stuff. Mars really does inspire such good science fiction, of course, starting with the War of the Worlds, where Woking, where I come from, is destroyed.
I know. Yes, I've been to Horsell Common and seen the sandpit where it landed, yes.
Indeed. Well, my house was actually built before then, so according to the book, the Martian came within a few hundred yards of our house.
Oh, wow, it's still standing then.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, back to Mars. One of the pictures that I've included, it was taken on June the 2nd by the other rover, Curiosity. As I say, almost the twin Perseverance, but several years older, and so Perseverance has got much more up-to-date kit on it. But Curiosity has sent back a fantastic image from the slopes of Mount Sharp, which it is slowly climbing up. And there's a part of the rover itself is included in this picture, so it gives you an idea of scale. But again, there's some fantastic sedimentation shown. And the sedimentary layers are one on top of the other and are extremely flaky and have crumbled. So it looks as though these were mud or something like that, mud layers, in either stream beds or small ponds. But it's fantastic detail and yet more evidence of the existence of liquid water at one time on Mars. And on Earth, wherever we find water, even if it's in subterranean areas under the Arctic ice cap, there's life of some kind. So perhaps there was. I'd like to believe so. Well, a month ago, but it's only just been released by NASA, there's another picture taken a month ago by Mount Sharp, Curiosity of Mount Sharp itself, which is a splendid picture, so I've included that too. And what the researchers looking at the data have found, that as Curiosity gets higher up Mount Sharp, so there is less sign of water and more sign of there being sulfates and things of that sort. And some rocky outcrops that are shown in this particular picture are believed to be of that nature, sulfates of some kind. Okay, so that's it for Mars. Let's move on to further out in space with a European involvement. A fantastic satellite out there called Gaia. Gaia was launched in 2013. It's a European Space Agency satellite, but with a very important British component. Gaia was put into one of these Lagrange points. It's the L2 Lagrange point. And just to remind people, a Lagrange point is one of several spots in space where the Earth's gravity and the Sun's gravity effectively balance out. So you can park a spacecraft there in such a way that it doesn't need much fuel for station keeping. That means you don't have to have so much fuel on board, which leaves you more room for instrumentation and so on. So the camera on board this spacecraft was actually built in Britain by a company called E2V Technology, who are in Chelmsford. And it's an incredibly sensitive camera. It's a billion pixel camera. And its sensitivity is such that if you're in London and you could measure the width of a human hair, that's in New York.
Goodness me.
Which is staggering, isn't it? But it has to be this accurate because it uses the idea of parallax to judge distance. Now, parallax is something we have from our stereoscopic vision. I'm sure everybody at home has, at some time or another, have put their thumb out, looked with one eye, and then opened the other eye, and the object has moved several feet from the thumb because, using the other eye. But that's with a baseline of only a couple of inches between our eyes. Now, the baseline that Gaia uses is Earth's orbit around the sun. Okay, so 93 million miles to the sun, so the baseline is 186 million miles. And don't forget, it's a million miles from Earth anyway. Gaia has been up there since 2013 collecting a fantastic amount of data. But it's only had, up until now, two releases of the data. All that data needs collecting and processing. So the Gaia team have just, only this month, have released the third tranche of data. So it's now looked at 2 billion sources of data, mostly stars. That's its job, to look at the stars of the Milky Way, work out what they're made of, how bright they are, how close they are, and also their motion, the direction of travel. But this latest release has continued the work of looking at these 2 billion stars, but for the first time it's now had spectroscopy. Now, spectroscopy is when, we're used to it from the rainbow, if you like. You can split light into its various wavelengths, and those wavelengths with something across the rainbow spectrum called little dark lines called Fraunhofer lines tell you what elements are contained in that, the source of that light. So that spectroscopy data, tells us something about the chemistry of the objects that it's looking at, the temperature, the mass, and they've done that now for millions of objects, so that data is coming back. They've also looked at, because they're looking for bright lights, some bright lights aren't in the Milky Way, they're a long, long way away, they're quasars. Now, quasars are distant galaxies, but that are extremely bright, and that's because they've got a voracious, supermassive black hole at their centre that's destroying stars, and the energy that's released causes this exceedingly bright light. So it's studied 1.9 million of these. It's just astounding, the work that it's doing. But it also picks up reflections of light in our own solar system as it's looking around. And so these are from asteroids, well, planets as well. But it knows about planets, but it's learning about asteroids. And it's mapped 156,000 of those. So we'll get a much better handle on which ones might one time come somewhere near us in plenty of time, hopefully, for us to do something about it, if we possibly can. One really surprising discovery from this recent data is that it can do something that wasn't expected, and that's called astroseismology. Seismology is, the study of earthquakes on Earth. It's found that it's so sensitive that when it's looking at a star, it can detect whether that star is spherical or not.
Goodness me, isn't it clever?
So, in other words, what it's found is that the star, during the course of its study, has changed shape slightly because the star is experiencing starquakes. Same way that we do.
A new word, starquakes.
Starquakes, absolutely. So internal disturbances, which all stars suffer from, but they're so great in some of these stars that it's actually distorting the usual globular, or mostly globular shape of the stars. So that's been quite a surprise. It wasn't designed to do it, but it's so sensitive that it's returned data that shows this must be the case. So the data that's come back so far only covers the first 3 years of its operation. So remember I said it was launched in 2013. So there's 5 or 6 years data that has or operation for which data is still being collected and transmitted back to Earth for processing. So that data is yet to be released, and no doubt will reveal even more incredible new knowledge. The spacecraft itself should keep going till 2025, collecting data until then and sending it back. So it'll probably be another decade before all of that data is assembled, processed and released. And one of the things that they're expecting it to do is to tell us more about exoplanets. I mentioned earlier that the satellite Gaia is studying the motion of a star. It can tell its path. Well, if a star had no planets, that motion would be a dead straight line. But if it's a slight wobble, that's because the gravity of its planetary system is affecting its travel. Now, it's too soon for that to have been studied by Gaia as yet, because it's only done 3 years' worth of study. But by the end of its life, it's thought that it could probably identify tens of thousands of exoplanets. We already know through other satellites, such as Kepler, that we've got 4,000 other exoplanets discovered. You know, when I was a little lad, you know, we thought we had 9, you know, and that was it. But now 4,000 plus, several more thousand as candidates yet to be proved as exoplanets, and Gaia will be coming up with a lot more. Also, all exciting stuff.
Absolutely. Amazing what they can do these days.
Indeed. And it's good to see this European project and that it's a good British involvement in that as well. Sadly, Brexit will mean less of that, which is very unfortunate. Back to NASA and some miscellaneous space news items now. The James Webb Telescope, I remember saying to you and the listeners last month, Graham, that they said its optics were perfect, couldn't be improved upon. It's been a slight change to that, sadly, but it's only marginal. But NASA has announced that a little micrometeor has banged into the James Webb Telescope, one of its primary mirrors segments.
Oh dear.
Yeah, there's 18 of them. So after this perfect focus, it's been one of them has been knocked slightly off perfect. But they've been able to adjust it as best they can. And the NASA spokesman reporting this said that following readjustment, it is only marginally detectable. But I'm slightly worried because it's such a big spacecraft, such a big mirror, that if in only its first few months of deployment one micrometeorite has hit, what's the chance of more causing damage? But its first release of images, which are anticipated to be so much better than what we've seen from Hubble, and those are just brilliant, should be within the next fortnight. So do watch the news. I'm sure it'll get a lot of attention on the national news. Still with NASA, I reported last month that they'd had to wheel their massive great rocket, the Space Launch System, back to the building for the vertical assembly building for repairs after a test failed. It was called a wet dress rehearsal at Kennedy. And it's a necessary benchmark before this massive 322-foot-tall rocket can be launched on its first mission, which is an unmanned test flight of the next generation lunar module, which is called Orion, around the moon. I'm glad to say that the test that they did this month has worked. Mostly. The main thing was to get the 750,000 tons of fuel loaded. And this is cryogenic fuel, which is very dodgy stuff, loaded and also unloaded. And all of that went fine. They have found a couple of small software issues and also a mechanical issue, a stuck valve. But they believe that all of those issues can be dealt with without needing to repeat this huge and very expensive and time-consuming test. So we're all go for the launch in late August or early September of the SLS, the Space Launch System, which is about the same size as the Saturn V that we're familiar with. And whilst we're talking about rockets, just to tell you that there's a new member of the Spacefaring Nations Club, and that is South Korea. They're the 11th member. They follow North Korea, which was the 10th, but the North Koreans just used one of their ballistic missiles, modified it, and sent up a very tiny package, but at least they could claim to have been in orbit. South Korea have followed up with their own specially built launcher, a three-stage liquid-fueled launcher called Nuri, and this one is a proper commercial rocket. It has a payload of 1,500 kilograms, and it took six satellites up into orbit from South Korea only a few days ago on June the 21st. Now, Britain, of course, sadly, was a member of that Spacefaring Nations Club and was the only one to have given up the capability after our success with Black Arrow launcher. But we will, of course, be launching in a month or so's time. I'm not sure if it's July or August when a Virgin Galactic orbital Boeing 747 takes off from Spaceport Cornwall, the old RAF St Athan, with an RAF officer at the controls. He's on loan to Virgin Orbit, and that'll take a launcher under its wing, and then that launcher will separate, fire, and go take satellites into orbit, several of which are built in Britain as well, one certainly from South Wales. As I reported last month, a company called Orbex will be launching also later this year from Spaceport Sutherland on the north coast of Scotland. So we'll be back in the space race. Let's see what's next. Ah, yes, I remember. Well, we usually talk about SpaceX. Dave always enjoyed talking about SpaceX.
They haven't sent any more cars up into space.
No, right. No. That, I wonder what the state of that Tesla is. Have the AA been up there? Has its tyres deflated?
Battery's flat.
Yeah, probably. What was it? It was playing an Elton John track, wasn't
it? Oh, yeah,
it
was. I think so, yeah.
That's right. Oh, dear. Anyway, last month I mentioned, and I thought this was tremendous, they'd set a record of launching three Falcon 9s within 3 days, which is tremendous going. However, they've beaten that in June. Between the 17th and the 19th, they've launched three Falcon 9s within a day and a half, 36 hours.
My goodness.
Really is a tremendous launch cadence to achieve. Two have gone from Kennedy, where SpaceX have two separate launch pads, and the other one went from their place at the Air Force's base at Vandenberg in California. And another record set as part of that was one of the Falcon 9 boosters was making its 13th flight, which is incredible. The way they're bringing down the costs by reusability is got to be the way to go. They've also had some approval for moving forward with their massive super heavy Starship combination. They had to get permission from the Texas state authorities to be able to launch such a massive rocket from Boca Chica, which is their headquarters in Texas. And that legal approval has now been achieved, having considered all social, domestic, and environmental factors. And of course, the business factor was probably the one that overrode all of these others. that means that the launch is now one step closer and is expected later this year. That first launch is purely a test, and it's to achieve orbit, or almost a whole orbit, coming down in Hawaii, but it's not to test the reusability. So these the Starship, which will be the second stage, will come down, pretend to land, but just go into the sea, and Super Heavy will do the same. But that will come down somewhere in the Atlantic. However, they are also getting ready for when they will use Starship commercially for its launches at Kennedy. So the construction is now well underway at the Kennedy Space Center for the launch tower. They've now got that half completed. You might remember me telling Dave and the listeners all about something called Mechzilla. The idea is that you have this massive great tower, and the Starship, the Super Heavy rather, the booster part of it, won't actually land on its landing legs. It doesn't have any. What it'll do is it'll come down and hover alongside the tower, and then these mechanical arms will come out and grab it either side and hold it in place, and then it'll be lowered. So it's just like a combination of Godzilla and this tower. So I love that name, Mechzilla.
Yeah, brilliant name, John.
Yeah. One of the pictures, Graham, that I've included in the slide set, listeners might like to look at, those particularly who remember going to see the film Gravity. Now, in the film Gravity, it was set on the International Space Station, and the heroine was played by Sandra Bullock. And, well, Sandra Bullock's as good a reason as any to go and see a film. And she played an astronaut called, a scientist called Dr. Stone. Now, there's one particular picture of her up in the International Space Station in sort of gym sort of outfit in their mock-up of the space station, of course. But that's just been reprised by a real-life astronaut. There's a European astronaut, an Italian lady called Samantha Cristoforetti. She's on her second visit to the space station. On her first, she was the one that took up, being Italian, an espresso machine to install on the space station. She's an ex-Italian Air Force fighter pilot as well. So she has just reprised this exact same pose in front of the actual place that was modelled in the film, and there she is floating in space. So the picture is of the two of them, Sandra Bullock and Samantha Cristoforetti. But she released this on Twitter. She's called at Astro Samantha, if anybody wants to follow her. And what she said on that tweet was, "Hey, Dr. Stone, quick question for you. How did you get your hair to stay put? Hash asking for a friend." Which I thought was splendid. And of course, in the picture of her, her hair is unbound by gravity, and so he's floating all over the shop. Whereas, of course, Dr. Stone, yeah. Sandra Bullock, I think was earthbound.
Well cured, yes, indeed.
But a bit of fun.
Indeed. Truth takes over from fiction, eh?
Indeed. Well, that's it. That is my look at the things that interested me that have happened in the last month in both astronomy and spaceflight.
Thank you, John, for that summary of life in space over the past month. Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month. So, John, what's the constellation of the month?
Well, this month it's Hercules. It's actually one of the largest constellations, the fifth largest, but very few people seem to know it unless they're astronomers. And it's not actually that easy to find. And that's mainly because its stars are only at about a third magnitude. So in the slides I describe how to find it. And also tell you about the reason why you should find it, because there's two absolutely splendid globular clusters in there. The best one in the Northern Hemisphere, in fact, is there, and it's called the Hercules cluster, M13 in the Messier list. But there's also another one which is almost as good, called M92. So they're tremendous objects through a small telescope. But apart from that, the constellation is home to several really attractive double stars too. So do get out there, folk, and try and find this constellation. Follow the guidance that I give in the separate little video and also in the slides that accompany.
Indeed, well worth a look. Thank you, John, for your constellation of the month. The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey. So, John, what we got to look forward to this month?
Well, despite the fact that the sky is still fairly light and not true darkness, but there's still some really good constellations to look at. And the sky can be remarkably clear in midsummer too, when you get a bit of rain washing the dust out of the air. So some good constellations include Bootes with the bright star Arcturus, which is probably one of the first stars that would come out at night. So if you look up and you see a pinkish reddish glint high in the sky, perhaps about 45-50 degrees high in the west, that's Arcturus, the main star of Bootes. And not too far away from that, in fact, is Hercules, my constellation of the month. It sits between Bootes and the other bright star that you're likely to see, getting towards overhead but slightly to the east as darkness falls, is Vega, which is the main star of the constellation Lyra. And near to that is the swan Cygnus, with a not quite so bright star called Deneb. But Cygnus is good because that sits right over the Milky Way. And running binoculars down the Milky Way, which in the middle of this month, in the middle of the night, could be almost overhead, is a fantastic experience. There are just so many stars. And because it's almost overhead, it's away from the dust and the murk in the thicker parts of the atmosphere as you go start looking lower towards the horizon. That's why the summer sky can be so good. But we've also got another good constellation coming up in the east, and that is Pegasus, together with Andromeda, with the Andromeda galaxy in there, which can actually be seen naked eye, just as a faint misty patch, if you know exactly where to look, and your eyes are probably younger than mine. But I can still just about find it, but only in a really, really dark sky sight. So that's it for the constellations. Get out there, keep looking. If you're interested in looking at the moon in July, probably the best time is around the first quarter on the 7th. And if you want to read about astronomy, do that when it's full moon, because the full moon just washes out so many of the fainter stars. New moon is the time to do, and full moon is on the 13th, I should have said. New moon is on the 28th, a fortnight after that, and that's the time when the moon doesn't brighten up the sky at all. So that's when we get out to look at the fainter objects. And of course, as we're now in July, that means we're past the summer solstice. So the nights are beginning to draw in.
What a shame, yes.
So we're starting to get darker nights as this month and August, September, and so on, roll by. Planets, I'm afraid they're all morning planets, so I'm not a morning person. And from where I live, although I might get up in the night for various reasons, I can't look out the window and see morning planets because there's too many trees about. But if you're in a similar position, then look out of the window. If you've got a good eastern horizon, then you'll see the bright lights of Venus and Jupiter and so on. Mercury is the first on my list, so first few days of the July, you can see that it rises about 70 minutes before the sun in the northeast, but only for the first week or so, because it then gets too close to the sun in terms of line of sight, and it becomes in fact an evening planet when it comes out t'other side of the sun, but it will be poorly placed, but an evening planet in August. Venus is the brightest, shining at magnitude minus 3.8, which is really bright in the east-northeast, a couple of hours before sunrise. And Mars, another morning object, improving as the month goes by. It rises by month end a little after midnight, so we're starting to becoming more accessible to us. Jupiter is another improving morning planet, again a negative magnitude, minus 2.4, that's in the south. That rises already at about 12:20 at the start of the month and near 11 o'clock at night by the end, so becoming an evening planet by the end of July, if you can see that low to the horizon. Saturn, it already is, that arises at 11 o'clock now, but of course it's so low that it's not really visible or observable till the morning. But by the month end, it'll be rising at 9:45, so should become accessible in the relative darkness in the south by the end of the month. Both Uranus and Neptune are telescopic objects, but are starting to become visible in the east as a morning planet, and Neptune also by the end of the month in the southeast. Things to watch out for in terms of astronomical phenomena. Well, the 4th of July, a lot of people think of it as Independence Day, but astronomers think of it as Aphelion Day, which means that the elliptical orbit that Earth has around the Sun, that's the day when Earth is at its furthest from the Sun.
I never knew that.
Ah, now you do.
Every 4th of July.
Indeed. Indeed, yeah. So it's not fair, is it? You know, when we're having our summer, because of the tilt of the axes, we're pointing in the right way to get good sunlight in the northern hemisphere, but we're at the furthest point. Whereas the Aussies, they're at the closest point to the sun when they have their summer. Ah, dear. On the 10th, we can use the moon to help us find, not a planet this time, but a nice bright star called Antares, which is in Scorpius. So the moon will just be 2 degrees from Antares, which means rival of Mars, Antares. So it's a red star. The moon can also help us to find several of the planets throughout the month. On the 15th, when it rises at 11:30, Saturn will only be 5 degrees above it, so quite close. And a similar sort of distance, Jupiter will be near the moon in the early hours of the 19th. On the 22nd, the moon will point you to 2 planets, but you'll need a telescope for one of them. Mars will be one side of the moon at 2:30 in the morning, the other side, the same distance away, just 2 degrees away, there'll be Uranus. So difficult to pick out because it'll be a similar brightness to some of the background stars, maybe a little brighter, but it won't scintillate because it's not a point of light, it's a small disk, and it has this greenish-bluish colour. So hopefully you'd be able to spot it. The moon can point you towards a wonderful star cluster. That's the Pleiades. On the 23rd, the moon will be just about 4 degrees or so below them. Again, in the morning, 2 o'clock. The moon will make a nice sight near Venus. Early morning, 4 o'clock, on both the 26th and the 27th. So the moon will be one side of Venus on the 26th, and then it'll have moved, 15 or so degrees around by the end of the next day, the 27th. So it'll be t'other side of Venus, but a nice sight, the crescent moon with the bright planet. On the 28th and through to the 30th, you can get out there and do a bit of meteor watching. This shower is called the Delta Aquarids. It peaks over these nights. Now, there aren't that many of them, but the radiant of the shower is well placed. It's almost vertically overhead. So that means that you're looking through a relatively thinner patch of the sky. Also, the moon is out of the way, so it won't wash out some of the fainter ones. And this sort of meteor, the trails it leaves behind are quite bright. So it is worth trying. So just get out there, face any direction you like in a deck chair, lean back and look up about 66 degrees, something like that. The meteors could come in any direction, but seemingly to come from the zenith directly overhead. I then normally move on to meetings at local societies, but because it's July, it's often AGM time, so there aren't quite so many to tell you about. The only ones I'll bother to mention are Yule Astronomical Society, who on Friday the 8th at 8 o'clock at Nonsuch High School for Girls, Cheam, have got Professor Brad Gibson from the Centre of Astrophysics at the University of Hull talking. But last time I looked, the subject matter hadn't been announced on their website. Croydon, it's all have 2 meetings, but it's all AGM and summer quiz. Guildford AS, it's AGM and still Zoom, but hoping to move back to some physical meetings for next year. But at Farnham AS, we've got on the 12th of July, Tuesday, at Aldershot Cricket Club, William Joyce talking about the geology of the moon. So I shall go to that meeting. That's a topic of interest to me. The astronomy on TV, the sky at night is on the 11th of July and repeated on the 14th of July. So they've moved from their Sunday 10 o'clock slot to Monday 10 o'clock on BBC Four, but still the Thursday 7:30 for the repeat. Now, this episode is called The Sky at Day. The BBC literature says, "We all know what it's like to plan a night of stargazing, only to find it's forecast to be cloudy. Again." So this month the team explore what you can see in the sky during the day, from the Parker Solar Probe to solar observing. So I imagine that's looking at, you know, what images you can look online from and research from the Parker Solar Probe. But Chris and Maggie take a look at what our sun has to offer, while Pete Lawrence reveals what other kinds of celestial phenomena can be seen before sunset. So perhaps that's atmospheric things like sun dogs or green pillars at sunset and so on. So we all like a little bit of armchair astronomy from time to time, so we can do that courtesy of the BBC with Sky at Night. And that's it, Graham. That concludes this final episode.
Well, John, it's been an amazing series. As I said earlier, 5 years you've been doing this with us, and I know for over 10 years, is it, as well?
For my U3A, yes.
Yes, which is, this is all based on, and we've all been fascinated. And I know Dave particularly has enjoyed doing the series with you, and we send you our best wishes for the future.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed doing it, and it's been fascinating seeing how a radio station operates, and it's doing a grand job for the local community. And as long as I've interested a few people and maybe started a few youngsters out on the road to astronomy, then I'll have done my job.
Indeed, indeed. And we hope at some point we can resume the series.
Happy to think about that.
Thank you, John. And you can hear this program again on Monday night at 11 p.m, and it will be available as a podcast, a longer edition with more that we couldn't fit in on the live broadcast.
Stars Over Surrey, the monthly guide to the night sky.